time, we still talked about the RMI, remote method invocation. This time I want to quickly wrap this up in talking about servlets, which are a well-known method with respect to using this approach in the context of the browser or web applications. And usually what you have here is something like a servlet engine, and which executes the servlet code, usually written quite often in Java, and then you have the web server, and then usually the web browser, which basically then displays the results of the produced information, and then shipped back by the HTTP protocol or some other protocol from the server to the client. The important part of it is here, it allows to something, it's an for building web-based application, I mean building web-based application, and the interesting part of it, it's component-based. I mean, it's component-based and platform-independent. What does it mean here? Platform-independent. And this allows to... And usually here, these ones, the servlet code, that's persistent. And that means if it started and initialized, then basically the code stays around until the servlet is terminated, or the servlet engine or the web server is basically terminated and restarted. But usually then when you start it, when it's initialized once, then basically it's available for the next request and immediately started. And if you think of a CGI script is reloaded every time when a request is initiated. And therefore, the startup time is usually a lot longer when compared with a servlet, which is already up and running. The some of the the properties here, you have certain environments which provide already. Servlet support, for example, Apache Tomcat, where it's basically part of it and it's integrated into the web server, and the servlet is usually basically just a Java class which is loaded into the servlet engine and then executed, and we have three methods or three main methods available. Certainly when it's started and initialized with init, then on the other hand you have something like a shutdown, the reverse of it, and then to handle requests sent from the client, basically the service method. And when you look at it, how you request it, basically the you have here the form, and then just use regular HTTP to invoke it. And when we look at the life cycle, as I mentioned here, you with init service and destroy or shutdown. You have here, you at the beginning when it's invoked the first time, the classes, it's loaded. The servlet class is loaded into it. It creates the servlet using the constructor, and then basically invokes the init method or initialize method, and then it's available for being executed. Each thread, that means each time a new request is sent, a new thread is basically created. And so therefore it's not just one process which basically handles the servlet requests. For each request, a new thread is created. So here, new thread for each request. And that means you can handle a number of servlet requests basically in parallel. And because they are threads, therefore they can also exchange or reuse data between them. And the servlet is destroyed or shut down. In a sense, you can have a timeout associated with it in case there's no request sent to the servlet anymore for a certain period of time. Or the system administrator basically shuts it down, or it can also be that the web server basically is shut down. Because, I mean, the servlet engine, if you look at Apache Tomcat, it's basically closely related to the execution of the web server. The next thing, quickly, the interface, what you have here, the servlet methods. You have here additionally methods to do certain configuration. And then you have and that's basically something like a protocol independent part of it. And then usually what you have is an HTTP protocol interface, and there you use just the regular HTTP protocol methods and with get, post, delete, put. I mean, that's what you know from HTTP. And they are basically mapped onto the appropriate method here from the servlet, which is usually just the service. And certainly delete could be then mapped to the appropriate destroy. And init, that's more or less when the servlet is started the first time. And if you look at Do I have something else here? If you have this class, you basically override the generic things. And the structure of a servlet, I mean, if you look at it from this type of thread, it extends the servlet, you have the init where you do the initialization, then do get, do post, destroy, which basically override the methods from HTTP servlet. And if you look at an example of it, as we have here, the do get method here. In that sense, you set here the response data type. You send it back as text and HTML. Here, that's the output stream, also the response stream. So here, out, that's basically the response stream to send the information back to the client, and then here the use the compute the current time, and then basically and close the stream again. I mean, here that's the output stream, and then you basically send the information out to the stream, which is then sent back to the client and presented in the web browser. And that's more or less the invocation of the servlet here. And therefore, here you have the directory of the servlet where it's located, because the web server needs to find it where it is, and then here the name of it. And that certainly here HTTP, that's the GET method when you invoke that. And localhost can be any other host or IP address, where the servlet would be located. Certainly, that's rather easy to program, and that's another way of writing distributed application. And the advantage of compared now with RMI and RPC. RPC and RMI are specialized protocols, and therefore the client and the server basically have to match. If you write something like a generic application where you say, well, I use HTTP, and there you have a predefined functionality in the sense of get, put, and also the way how you transport data between the client and the server, as well as the reverse. It's basically a completely well-defined interaction protocol between client and server. And that makes life a lot easier. Certainly, it's not as efficient, because you have more overhead with respect to the information going back and forth, and it's usually string-based. With RMI, you can have more a binary transport between the client and the server. Therefore, it can be a lot more efficient transport between the two partners. But on the other hand, it's much with servlet, it's much easier and much faster to realize. The execution is certainly a little bit usually slower than if you use remote method invocation. Later on, in the context of web services, there's also the REST interface. And that usually also is based on web-based protocol. And therefore, you have a lot less flexibility with respect to the methods. But on the other hand, with GET/PUT, you're more or less fixed with the protocol. And therefore, if you write the client, it's much easier, because you don't really have to check, well, what kind of functionality is supported, especially if you think of SOAP. With REST, you know what's supported, and that's it. And therefore, the writing an application is a lot easier. You'd use this style, like servlets or REST, very often if you want to quickly write a distributed application and not really put a lot of effort in interface chasing how the methods or the protocol look like. But we come back with to the rest style again, and which has a lot of similarity with servlets. We look at certainly a few basics, and what we handle here is data representation in a heterogeneous environment, execution model, and especially here in the context, what's interesting also is time, because time is a certain way of providing an execution model, especially if you think of first that is done, then that is done, then comes the third thing, and so on, where you could use time as something like an ordering of operation execution. But we can have also, as we will see, something like a logical execution order of operation. How do we handle errors? Then distributed transaction, especially if you want to have something like a transaction which spawns across multiple servers. And then we have to think of how do we handle commit and abort. We can look at group communication like algorithms, and here like the variations of multicast, like serialized multicast, atomic multicast, and so on. There exist different variations of it. And closely related to these things beforehand are something like to do group communication and to basically order the messages, how they are propagated to all the partners and how they are then actually delivered to the individual application components, in which order, therefore to maintain a consistent state. Another thing is what we look very quickly is authentication. And like if you have client and server, how they are authenticated each other, and to handle that someone is really certain that this is the client it presumes to be, or this is a server it basically says it is, and therefore to verify if that's really the case. The external data representation, certainly it's not a problem if you have a homogeneous environment, but if you have a heterogeneous environment, that's a lot more difficult. Heterogeneous means you have a different operating system. Heterogeneous means you have a different runtime environment, or heterogeneous with respect to the exchange of information across the network. And it's important that we have to have something like a representation of the data which where the semantics are preserved across the network between the client and the server environment. And therefore, if the client sends, like, let's say, the value 10, then also the value 10 must be also interpreted on the receiving end. And the important thing is here, what we want to have is an independence of hardware characteristics, as well as we can also say in runtime characteristics. And if we look at the two things, and that refers to the parameters for the invocation as well as the results. And to transport data structures. and marshalling and unmarshalling. What we mean here is if the client sends a request to the server, it provides arguments. These arguments can't be sent as a whole data structure, as we can do that, for example, in between the CPU and the main space or the main memory to exchange across the bus, where you basically have 64 four bits to transport the whole, like a string or a data structure. Here, basically, usually you serialize the parameters. It's bit by bit, which is sent over to the server, and then you unmarshal the serialized stream, and then you basically create here the data structure again, and to get the same thing what the client sent. Therefore, in that sense, it's martial and unmartial. It comes from military. If you look at people lining up and standing there, one military personnel by the other, and that's the same thing is here. Take the data structure, serialize it, send it over, and unserialize it here again. And the marshalling, that's basically the it can be provided by the RPC system, and that's usually by standard data types, and the standard data types it could be let's say integer, it can be a string, it can be Boolean, and so on. These are standard data types. But then you have something like here, plugins by the application programmer, and that would be something like complex data types. And depending what kind of programming language you use, you can have this record data structure. You can have struct if you work in a C environment. Therefore, you have a whole bunch of possibilities to combine sub data types to a more complex data types. And they basically have to be mapped. Then how do you marshal and how do you unmarshal? For example, if you have a data type like a tree, and then the application programmer as a plugin has to provide how the tree is basically parsed, and to avoid any circles, to basically parse the tree, and then on the other hand to rebuild the same tree again to avoid any mismatch between the data structure here and the data structure here. And it also means that, for example, if we have here the on the client side something like this, A, B are a certain data, and then we have C. They both point to the same. And on the other hand, when we send this data here to the server, because we sent now here A, we sent B, we sent C, and therefore we don't want to have the situation that we have here a pointer to C, let's call it C1, and a pointer B to C2. We have to map it to the same thing here as we have it on the client side. Therefore, on these complex data types, the application programmer has to provide something like a plugins to serialize and to marshal the data structure, and then to unmarshal it and set up the data structure on the receiving end. The other thing is what we also have with respect to the representation and data representation. Certainly, if the client and the server have separate representations, and the point is, who does the transformation? And we could decide and say, well, we have a node A and a node B, and the transformation is done always by the node B. Therefore, the node B knows all the data representations by all other nodes. Therefore, if a new node joins the distributed application network, then the node B has to be informed which data representation is used here, for example, for strings, for arrays, for integers, or for other type of data types. And this one would then do the transformation. And also, if this one sends then the data here, it would transform it into the format understood by the node A. Problem is here, we have something like a single point of failure. And if that's not available, then we might have a problem. The tendency is to go more on a distributed transformation approach. And the distributed transformation means here all the nodes are involved in the transformation. And if the node A sends something to node B, I mean, here we have three approaches here, variant 1, variant 2, variant 3. Here, if A transform data, which are then sent to B, therefore node A knows what B understands. It's something like if you look at two people, one a German and one a US American understanding English, then this one would write his letter in English, sends it over, this one would understand the letter, and then writing the response in German. Therefore, in that sense, you always transform it into the format understood by the other partner. Problem what you have here is certainly if a new node comes here, A prime, in order to communicate with other nodes, this one has to understand what the other nodes understand, and also the already existing nodes have to know what this node understands. And therefore, in that sense, it makes it rather complicated that if new nodes join the network, because they have to make known what kind of data structures and formats they understand. And the other possibilities here, this one, if you take with the German and English approach, the German would send the letter in German, the English would send the letter in English, and if this one sends the letter in German, then this one receives it in German and then transforms it into English. Therefore, the transformation is done on the receiving end. Here, in the first case, the transformation was done by the sending site. Point is here also, you have the same problem if somebody new comes. This one sends in A prime. In order to transform it, well, he has to know what kind of data representation it has. A possibility would be that actually the node A does not just send the data, it also sends information about the representation. And that was done by certain approaches. For example, by the OSF DCE, Distributed Computing Environment, which was supposed to be the intention was that it would become a standard. There was standard committees, but it was not really then actually it was finalized and it was submitted, but then basically there came then afterwards a de facto standard by Sun, and then the standard was not really used by many other companies. But they used, if iPrime came, they not just sent the value, but also the information about the data representation. Therefore, that extended or made the data communication larger, because you all sent format information. And that's the third one that was then proposed and promoted by Sun. They decided and said, well, let's take a network-wide standard for their representation of data types. Would be something like, if we take the analogy with English and German, you would say, well, we take Esperanto as the format. This one in German would translate into Esperanto. This one would receive in Esperanto and then translate in English. And the same thing goes in the reverse. Therefore, you have a network-wide standard format. And if this new one comes, the only thing what this node has to understand is the network-wide format. And it doesn't have to transmit anything, or this one has to know what format. This node has no necessity. It's basically just using the standard-wide format, and every node knows the standard-wide format. The one, and what Sun basically used, they used their format, which they supported on their machines, and said, well, this is a network-wide standard. And because Sun was so successful then with the network file system, and also with ONC, and as a distributed application, that it became a de facto standard. And this approach here with variant 2 was basically overruled. And even if it was submitted and accepted, and the de facto standard basically became then the standard. And it was no special hardware needed. The main disadvantage was the following with this approach. That, for example, this node had a format which was different from XDR. That was basically the name of it, XDR. And this one had the same format, as this one. Therefore, in that sense, these two nodes spoke the same format, but it was different from XDR. Therefore, you have two transformations. Here, first in XDR, then you receive it in XDR, then you transform it back into the same format as you had here. And in that sense, you have two transformations, which basically costs an overhead. If you use XDR, you had no transformation. It's basically transformation without transformation. And we can look at certain representations, what XDR has. And it's here a machine-independent format. And it also provides a way to describe complex data structures, which then as an application programmer you could provide for transformations. And XDR is one example. We have, and that's used, so here used by NFS, And that was one of the reasons why it became then quite popular. Another one was here, ASN.1, this abstract syntax notation. That came more from the telecommunications industry. Here, XDR came from the computer industry. Here, that's from the telecommunication. Then, certainly, you had the CORBA common data representation. It's basically equivalent to XDR, but it's slightly different as a common external data representation. And then certainly you also have Java object serialization to flatten a single object into a single object or a tree of object and then ship it over across the network. And that would be used also, for example, by Java spaces. Therefore, to store data in a common data storage. We can look at certain at XDR now. If you look at CORBA or ASN.1, it's very similar. Therefore, it's not really had slight differences, but it's quite comparable. The one problem certainly you already have is how do you represent numbers? I mean, here integers in memory, and there are two approaches from in hardware architectures, and one is called the Big Endian and Little Endian, and here you would have something here that's the higher part of the number, the higher part, and on the other hand, the higher part is here. And if you look at it, here that's the integer number, and if you that's the memory address, 1,000. And here's 1,003, and that would be the representation of your integer number here, 1,347. If you have the little endian, you look at it, at 1,000, you have the lower part, and then to the higher part is here. And certainly, if you ship the number, and then you represent it, it then represent the number of it. And you will basically just ship the bits over one by one. And then you would put it in a different way in your memory. You would basically get another representation. Because if you put then the ship here on one end, you ship this here away bit by bit, and then you put it into the same memory in the same format as you had it here, then you get a completely different number. Because then the number is really high. Here, the number would be just 1,300. And that's the point of it, that basically you have to make a transformation to transform from a big endian into a little endian. And what was then decided for the external data representation, they used the big endian approach, and that was exactly how Sun in their Sun machines stored in main memory the data, the integer numbers. And if you have another, I don't know if Motorola used the reverse, but there were some, like I think the IBM representation or AMD, one of them, basically used the reverse representation. And therefore, they would have not been able to communicate correctly. And the external data representation was then the big endian. And if a little endian architecture received a big endian, it always transformed the data into this representation. The other thing is also, if you look at the runtime environment, how do you represent strings? If you do C programming, then you know the string ends when the null comes. You don't have anything with respect to the size. The size you compute in the way how you've take the start and then just count the characters. Well, if you take Pascal and there are certain other representations, there you have a counter and then you have the value of the string. And then it ends. There is no null. And if you would send that to a C environment, it would take this as a number and then basically as a symbol. And then this is a symbol, this is a symbol, this is a symbol, and then, well, it runs until it finds a null. And therefore, in that sense, the external data representation here that's mapped, you have 4 bytes of length, and then here the length of the string, and then basically you use it as a multiple of 4 bytes, as so here modular 4, in that sense, you add here a number of bytes just to get a 4-byte limit, and then here you put the length, and then you get 232 minus 1 length of a string. How do you arrays? That's another thing. How do you represent them? Here, the array, you have here the number of elements, and then you basically just have the individual elements because they all have the same data structure if you have an array. Therefore, in that sense, they all have exactly the same size. But what you end up is here as a counted array. Normally, you don't really have represented in your main memory as the length of your array. You have... It's basically part of the runtime environment that you know how many members you have. And the last thing we can look at it, how you transfer pointers. Certainly you can prohibit, you can dereference it, and then that's what we mentioned, and serialize the data structure, and then recreate it on the other end. That's a very common thing because that's what we called call by copy and restore. That's a very common way. You don't allow null pointers, because there you send something like a Boolean value for that. And the other point is no function pointers. If you do C programming, especially if you use libraries, it's very common, for example, if you do sorting, that as a function pointer, as an argument, you add the address of your of the sorting function into your part of it. And well, that's in a heterogeneous environment, that's not really acceptable, because even if you do a serialization of your data structure, well, you serialize the executable code and then you ship the executable code. What do you do on the receiving end with the executable code? Like sending from a C environment into a Microsoft environment. You can't really execute it. Certainly, if you use JVMs, well, there it is a possibility to handle that. Pointer transfer, and what you use in Java environments, that's the last thing here, sending stubs instead of pointers. And that's exactly here what you usually do, especially in the object-oriented environment. Here you don't really deserial, you don't flatten the data structure and send it. You basically just send a stub, and that's then the equivalent of your pointer, and that's the method of using in the remote method invocation. Okay, then let's stop here and